From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a Saginaw case leads to a federal appeals court ruling. Chalking tires to track how long you've parked is unconstitutional.
I'm very, very pleased, not only for myself, but for really a lot of people who have been plagued by the chalk on their tires for the last decades and decades and decades all over Michigan.
A Grand Rapids proposal would make it illegal to be a barbecue Becky, calling police on people of color just living their lives.
Please do not use 911 to exercise your racist behavior. That's essentially what we're saying.
A local physician shocked by the Easter Sunday bombings in his homeland of Sri Lanka.
I think we were moving towards a peace, and this reignited all of the ethnic divisions again.
And we'll meet the high school student representing Michigan at the National Poetry Out Loud competition. Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. That parking enforcement officer who marks your tire with chalk to keep track of just how long you've been parked? Well, thanks to Monday's opinion from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, that practice is unconstitutional. This ruling came in a case from Saginaw. And here with me now is Philip Ellison with Outside Legal Counsel. He's lead attorney in this case. How did it feel when you saw this ruling come from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals?
I have to say it's always extremely exciting when the federal judges say, yep, Phil, you got it right. And I'm very, very pleased, not only for myself and, of course, my client, Allison, but for really a lot of people who have been, I think, plagued by the chalk on their tires for the last decades and decades and decades around in municipalities all over Michigan.
So what sparked you to pursue this case? How did it all start?
Well, it's kind of a weird quirk. I was on the phone with a colleague of mine who was sitting down by the Saginaw County Courthouse, and the parking enforcement official came by, and she literally marked his tire with chalk mark. And he said, what right does she have to do this? And we got talking about a little bit, and next thing you know, I'm on a little research tangent, and we discover this very important U.S. Supreme Court case called U.S. v. Jones. And we said, you know what? It's just like U.S. v. Jones, except Jones was a tracking device. In this case, this is a low-tech tracking device. And so we literally then made a federal case out of chalking.
Because we're talking about Fourth Amendment, unreasonable search and seizure.
That's correct. Now, the ruling of the court is that it violates the Fourth Amendment because they didn't get a warrant. That's the key on this particular. So if the parking enforcement individuals get a warrant for every single time they mark a tire, which, of course, is impractical, but unless they get a warrant, they are violating the Fourth Amendment by putting a basically vandalism on the tire of your car.
And the plaintiff, Allison Taylor, had gotten, what, 15 tickets in 2 years?
That's correct. She works in downtown Saginaw. And one thing I want to be clear about with Allison, she didn't park improperly. She didn't park unsafely. It's just the city of Saginaw doesn't have enough parking spaces for those who live and work downtown Saginaw. And so as a result of that, folks like her are constantly paying kind of basically parking whack-a-mole with the parking enforcement folks. And as a result, she just got nabbed at the time we started the suit, 14. Shortly after we filed the lawsuit, she got her 15th ticket. And she's paid all but the last one of them. So, she's a conscientious citizen of Saginaw, you know, trying to do the right thing, but she just got tired of paying for parking tickets when there's no parking downtown.
And what did the city argue to rebut your claims?
Well, they tried a couple of different arguments, but their primary one was one called community caretaking. And what they tried to argue was is that we aren't really regulating parking, but instead we're really taking care of the community by running these parking ticket systems. So very similar, for example, if there's a car accident, for example, in the middle of a road, a cop doesn't have to go get a warrant to help push that car off the road. That's part of community caretaking because they're not doing a criminal investigation. They try to argue that they're like that cop pushing the car off the road when they're going through putting marks on the tires. And, of course, we said, no, you're not. You're there trying to put a mark on there to get evidence to hit them with a civil infraction ticket. Punish them. And as a result, that's like law enforcement. And as a result of that, the Sixth Circuit agreed with us and said, hey, this falls under a regulatory regime, not community caretaking. And so as a result, it comes back to the federal judge here in Bay City.
So what happens now? So your argument was first rejected in 2017. Now you get this opinion from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, clearly not buying the city's argument and overturning that lower court decision. So what happens now?
The next step for us, ironically enough, is we start the case. Originally, the case was filed. The city of Saginaw moved to dismiss the lawsuit, and the judge granted it almost immediately without a hearing. which was a very much of a surprise to us. So essentially, by the Sixth Circuit undoing everything that the lower court did, we essentially are back to square one, almost like the first day of the lawsuit. But going forward, the federal judge can't rule differently than the Sixth Circuit just did yesterday.
So how do you expect this to affect not only Saginaw, but other cities who use chalking to enforce parking restrictions?
Well, at least for the four states that the Sixth Circuit has jurisdiction over, that's Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee, it's now unconstitutional. It's a violation of the constitutional rights of citizens if parking enforcement officers, but they're out today marking with chalk, they're violating the Constitution in those four states. But I'm really hoping that this decision, you know, this is about $15 parking tickets at its core. But really what it's actually more correctly about is about the nature of the relationship between the government and the citizens, what their job is. And here it's our belief that the job of the government is not to try to collect as much money as they can from the citizens, but rather improve their quality of life and provide proper services like parking in downtown municipalities. Because, you know, if there's not enough parking, people can't live, work, and go to restaurants and enjoy downtown if the cities don't provide that kind of parking. And it's very, very easy for municipalities to say, we're not going to fix the parking problem because we're making a lot of money on it right now. And I'm hoping that's what will change with decisions like this one that came down yesterday.
And as the news is spreading about this decision, are you hearing from more people?
We are hearing from people all over the state of Michigan, at least, as to the fact that their municipalities have been using chalking and people getting hit with fines. And I'm suspecting this decision is probably going to put a pretty big damper into the operations of the chalk industry.
Philip Ellison, outside legal counsel, based in Saginaw, lead attorney on the case that found, at least in the states covered by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, tire chalking by cities, parking enforcement officers is not constitutional. Phil, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
And an update to this story. As of today, Michigan Municipal League Attorney Chris Johnson is advising communities without parking meters they may need to chalk the ground instead of that tire or come up with another way to keep track of how long a car is parked. We know the names: Barbecue Becky, Permit Patty, Coupon Carl, Cornerstone Caroline, and more. Nicknames the internet bestowed upon white people who call 911 to report black people who are doing nothing wrong. Many of these incidents get recorded on cell phones and then explode and go viral on social media. There is a proposal in the works in Grand Rapids that would make it illegal to call police on people of color who are just going about their lives. Lionel Legrone is chief author of the proposal. If this proposal is adopted into law in Grand Rapids, Lionel, what would it do?
What the proposal would do was stop people from making frivolous calls, or at least seriously discourage them from making frivolous calls to the police department. We've had a problem in Grand Rapids with the police being called on specifically African-American youth and pulling guns on them to find out that they're just walking around carrying out activities of daily living unarmed. What we want to do is discourage that with this proposal.
What would be the consequences of doing something like this?
So right now, the consequences are still being ironed out. We know right now the proposal says it will be a municipal infraction. We're still trying to figure out what the specific fine will be, but we hope that it will be significant enough to deter people from making those calls.
How do police feel about this? Because I've got to imagine someone white calling the police on someone just of color living their life, that puts police in a tough spot because they have to walk up and question somebody maybe barbecuing or having a party in a park because someone made a racially motivated 911 call.
Well, the officers I talked to have been very frustrated by these calls, first and foremost. Although we do have our issues in Grand Rapids with community police relations, we have some very good officers on the force. And when they do their jobs by responding to calls, they expect that the call is a serious call that they're being called to. And when they get there and find out it's nothing more than discrimination or a vendetta being carried out through the police department, it's frustrating to them. And I've heard them support this issue and say that they'd like for this to stop and pleased with that.
your proposal, it's not saying don't call 911. What does it say?
Essentially, what we're saying is if you suspect that a crime is taking place or there's something going on that the police need to be alerted to, feel free to call. But please do not use 911 to exercise your racist behavior. That's essentially what we're saying. Please stop it. What's happening when we had those calls, when the police pulled guns out on 9-year-old and 10-year-old and 11-year-old kids carrying out activities of daily living, we had cases where they were frivolous calls. And we're just asking people to stop that. But by all means, the 911 system is still in effect for you to call when you believe that you need emergency services. And we're asking people to continue to exercise that.
So what happens tonight at the city commission meeting?
The way I understand it, at the city commission meeting, what they're going to do is have a discussion on whether or not to bring the ordinance to a public hearing, which is the final hearing before its passage. We're actually encouraging the community to come out and speak out during the public comment period and express your thoughts and opinions on the ordinance.
And that'll be at 7 tonight at the City Hall. And more broadly, Lionel, how would you describe relations between white and black communities in Grand Rapids?
There's tension. There's tension there. I think overall, there are more people getting along than not. But, you know, this issue with the policing in Grand Rapids has driven a wedge between the races in Grand Rapids. And we're hoping that if we can get this resolved, if we can get this issue with police and community relations resolved in Grand Rapids, we'll start to see some mending between the black and white community. I mean, we're not at levels of rioting just yet. I mean, people are able to carry out activities of daily living with different races, but we are a few incidents away from having a really difficult relationship in Grand Rapids with one another.
Lionel Legrone, chief author of a new proposal in Grand Rapids, it would make it illegal to call police on people of color who are just doing everyday things. Lionel, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we always want to hear from you. We want to hear what stories are you focusing on, people or issues that you want to learn about. So let us know. It's easy to find us on Facebook. Search for Michigan Radio. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And of course, MichiganRadio.org. And just click the link that says Stateside. Coming up, we will hear all about this cross-border symphony orchestra that you can hear right there. That comes up after the break. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are countless ways that Michigan connects with Ontario. Of course, the Detroit-Windsor Tunnel, Ambassador Bridge, Blue Water Bridge. They're obvious connections, letting us crisscross the borders for business and recreation. Or maybe like me, you've got family ties. My mother grew up on a farm in Guelph, Ontario. And there's music that has been reaching across these borders since 1957. The International Symphony Orchestra, a semi-professional group of Canadian and American instrumentalists and singers. Its music director and conductor, Douglas Bianchi, is with us. Now, welcome. It's so good to have you here.
Well, thank you.
What better person to do this kind of cross-border effort? Because you have a cross-border story that's in your own life, don't you? From Canada to the U.S.?
Yes, well, I was born in Windsor.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was Canadian. My mother comes from Preston, England. Well, you know, in the late 50s, there was the recession. So we actually got a job at General Motors in Turnstead, downtown Detroit. So every Sunday after church, you know, back to the farm outside of Windsor with my grandparents.
You have straddled the border in your own life. And what is it that brought you to the International Symphony Orchestra, knowing you're already busier, director of bands and a conducting professor at Wayne State?
Well, with anything in life, you can get pigeonholed, you know, like, so I'm good at bands, I'm good at marches, I'm good at this kind of, you know, whatever. And I guess after a while, you want to prove to people, you know, I really do like opera. I really do like symphonies. You know, it's like there's more here than meets the eye.
So it gives a chance to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
So how many musicians and singers are in the International Symphony Orchestra?
Let's see. The choir's around 35, I believe. And then the orchestra is give or take about maybe 60 to 65. It depends on some of the literature.
And is there a sense as far as what percentage are U.S. and what percentage are Canadian, or does it vary?
Well, it's probably split right down the middle. You know, our offices are in Sarnia. And so we like to have Canadian content and let you have to perform in the soloist. But we do try to make sure that when we replace people, you know, like kind of even it out.
Yes.
So there's actually sections in the orchestra where they're all Canucks or Yanks, you know. So they're all over the place.
And is that also where you rehearse?
No. Okay. We actually rehearse on the American side at St. Clair County Community College.
So there is very much a sense of back and forth.
Oh, yes, definitely. We have like a 6-concert series. Each concert is given on each side of the border.
Well, I'm thinking of times in having spent a lifetime crossing either at the tunnel or the bridge or heading up to the Blue Water Bridge sometimes to visit family. You never know when there's going to be a great big backup at the border, as you laugh ruefully. Have you had any?
Oh, my Lord, yes. Well, actually, I was told you should get one of those Nexus passes.
Yes,
you
know. With all these musicians and singers going back and forth.
Some do that. Seriously, there's times where like it'd be 5 o'clock in the afternoon and I've gone right over the bridge. But we had a concert in January, our annual Celtic concert's a big one. There was something at the border the night before. So on the American side, we're getting ready for the concert, and we've got some of the Canadians are kind of in a panic. So the next night, figured, well, that's not going to happen again. Oh, my Lord. I think I got there just about 5 minutes before downbeat. But we had already received text messages from our cello section. Well, I've been here for an hour and a half, and I'm still on the bridge. So we had to, you know, pedal a little bit. But our audiences, they kind of expect that, too. This is the only time I think we've actually delayed, but it was a Celtic concert. Our soloist, our group called the Steel City Rollers. And so they just said, well, yeah, we'll go and do a number or two, warm up the group. So there you go.
I was going to say, if you had a Celtic group, they could have gone all night.
And when the rest of the cello showed up, we went on with the show. But it can be a little, like even, well, the first concert when I was auditioning, there was a snowstorm. I left 3 hours earlier from Detroit because I knew the weather would be bad. And I actually got there an hour late. And I remember being at the border and the customs official was saying, well, this is a little late for our rehearsal. It's like, yes, so let me get going. Here I am already. It's 8:30. So I thought, well, that's the end of that job, you know.
Now, where do you draw from to get your musicians?
Port Huron and Sarnia area have their musicians local. And then we get a big contingency from the Detroit metropolitan area that's more closer to the Detroit side. And then we get some fine players that actually come from London, Ontario area. Now, the director previous to my tenure taught at Ontario Western in London. And so he was the director there and then would sometimes have the London students perform. And I work at Wayne State, so every once in a while if we're hard-pressed for a sub, I get to hire some of my students. So
absolutely. And I've got to wonder what it means for non-professional players, for amateur players, to sit alongside and play with professionals. I'm thinking back in my French horn playing days in school, it would have been very thrilling to play with a professional.
Right. Well, I think that's one of the draws. I mean, playing next to a professional, you can imagine that's kind of thrilling, except that a professional musician kind of has a certain code of conduct in rehearsal, of which they're at times completely oblivious. For example, the section leader is allowed to like raise their hand, ask a question to the maestro, let's say, because you're a little confused as to whether it should be staccato, legato, like the gesture isn't making sense to the musician, so you want to ask a question, or I think there's a note mistake there, whatever it is. Now, the pecking order means the section leader does the questioning, and then you as a section player, you just do whatever you're told, where amateurs, they just raise their hand like, it's like, not your place, you know?
Yeah.
So those are some of the vicissitudes of working with like, that kind of an ensemble. However, a lot of people have worked very hard in their life, and they wanted to be musicians when they grew up, but maybe because of family situations, finances, things like that.
Life leads you in another direction.
And so why shouldn't you be able to play? I think community orchestras really serve a purpose that way. Now, ours is actually semi-professional. We have a solid group of professional musicians that are not ringers. They play all the time. So this gets to be a little dicey when your ticket prices are almost like $30, $40 Canadian. You know, they say you have to give a quality product. That's really our goal
yes.
for Port Huron Sarnia, because if you live in those communities, why can't you have good arts programs and a good symphony and museums? I mean, really, you live there just because you say, well, I really do want to live an hour and a half away from a fine symphony orchestra. I don't mind taking the trip. No, this is where your life found you, mm-hmm. and you're entitled to good art, too, new music.
You know, I know your season finale is coming up.
Yes.
Give us a hint of what will be on the program as you wrap up your season.
Well, we're going to do Tchaikovsky's famous Pathetique, and that's quite a challenge. And talking about community players, that piece challenges everybody because, as we'd say in the business, it's quite a blow. Mm. But more importantly, it's a piece that has a very definite metaphysical bent, existential bent. This is not just a, hey, we're doing some Tchaikovsky's, because you make an 1812 overture, we got canons at the end, you're going to love it. So the challenges in rehearsal is to make sure we get everything right, but that we also say something with the music, because this piece does have things to say. I read once something by Confucius that man loves a beauty more than truth. So when you're on the podium, you know, truth, you got to get the right notes, the right rhythms, you got to get all that together. However, sometimes you can get everything right and not say anything. So big challenge there.
That's not the way you want to end your season.
No. But I understand ticket sales are really going well. And I was surprised last year, you know, we had this marvelous executive director, her name is Anne Brown. And when we were playing the season, I was surprised where she said, well, you know, the last time we did the Tchaikovsky Six, it was quite a hit. Our audiences love it. I said, well, I mean, it's a very likable piece, but you wouldn't expect community orchestras to say, well, let's go there and let's see how we can bring in an audience. But already there's lots of excitement. So it gives you an idea of the quality that people seek in their lives like that.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
So, yeah. Anyway, on the other side, we have an overture by Sir Ernest McMillan, mm-hmm. first conductor of the Toronto Symphony back in the day. And then we have some brass features. So our brass players, their lips are going to hurt after this weekend.
Okay. So it's April 26th at 7:30 at the Imperial Theater in Sarnia, and then April 27th, 7:30 p.m. at the McMorran Theater in Port Huron.
Right.
And you can absolutely go to the ISO.org and get all the information
yeah.
on the upcoming program, and then keep in touch for the upcoming season.
Yes, definitely.
Well, thank you so much, as we've talked to Douglas Bianchi, who is music director and conductor of the International Symphony Orchestra. Thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
It is time for Theater Talk as we check out professional theater productions all over the state. And as always, our guide is David Kiley of Encore Michigan. And it looks like we're beginning with a very beloved musical.
Yeah, Brigadoon at the Encore Musical Theater in Dexter. This is the Lerner and Lowe musical about two American tourists who stumble upon a mysterious Scottish village that only actually appears one day every 100 years. A lot of people will have seen the film version from the 50s with Gene Kelly and the amazing Sid Charisse. But, you know, I run into people all the time, Cynthia, who've never seen the original stage show.
Including the one sitting across from you at this table. I have not seen it.
I'm surprised when yeah. you like a lot of things Irish and Scottish. So it's a love story. It's a fantasy story. It also has that whole Scottish charm thing going on. One of the things I find really interesting about Brigadoon is where the influences came from when it was created. You had these popular rural musicals like Oklahoma and Carousel, kind of romanticizing rural life. You had the popularity of The Quiet Man film a few years earlier that really energized sort of Irish-American audiences. And then you had like the influence of the book and movie of Lost Horizon, which popularized this whole idea of Shangri-La, a magical kind of place. So all these creative forces and successes went into creating Brigadoon. It's a good story. Tunes are terrific. Almost Like Being in Love is kind of the big song. Mm-hmm. And everybody covered that. Sinatra, Ella
yeah.
Fitzgerald. And we have a piece of that right now.
Let's take a listen. This is from actually the 1957 cast album.
Day, this has been what a ramble I've been. Why, it's almost like being. There's a smile on my face for the whole human race. Why, it's almost like
Yeah, I'm sure you jogged everyone's memory with that song, because a lot of times we'll hear these songs and not realize they came from, you know, some terrific Broadway blockbuster.
Right. This is actually an example where a big, great song came from a very mm-hmm. successful musical. Sometimes there's a great song that comes from a dud. But that's at the Encore Musical Theater running through May 19th.
All right. And now we head to the Slipstream Initiative in Ferndale.
Right. Remember the old Monty Python? Now for something completely different?
Yes.
So this is a new play that recently ran off Broadway at the Slipstream, and it's called On the Exhale. Now, this is very different from what we just talked about. This play is structured like someone giving a TED Talk. And in this case, it's a mother played by a terrific actress named Tiaje Sabri, who I've seen before. She's the mother of a 12-year-old who was killed by a mass shooter who attacked a school. And she has a point to make in her talk, and this is not a sermon. It's designed, like any TED Talk, to make you think about an issue like you haven't thought about it before. And I get a chance to talk to Bailey Boudreau, who's the artistic director this week, and here's what he had to say about the play.
It's presented in the form of a TED Talk or a lecture. And so in that nature, it is not divisive. And so whenever you take a topic like gun violence, it's going to be incredibly divisive. You're going to have people on either side, and it can be a real turnoff and a real danger for a theater to do. And so the playwright very smartly put it in one person's perspective and structured it as though it were a lecture. We were there to hear the two opposing sides and somehow meet in the middle.
Wow. And when you think of just all the recent coverage of the Columbine anniversary, this is very top of mind for people.
And we're also, let's face it, we're heading into 2020. Mm-hmm. This is an issue that is actually, I think, going to get more play than it did 4 years ago. So,
all right.
That runs at the Slipstream Initiative in Ferndale through May 19th. It's a small theater you've probably never been to. Mm-hmm. But check us out on Encore Michigan, and you'll have all the directions.
Great. Now we head north on I-75 from Ferndale. We get off at University Drive and zip east over to the campus of Oakland University and Meadowbrook Theater.
Right. This is a transition again to the lighter side. Yeah. They're doing The Marvelous Wonderettes. It's a popular musical series about a group of women who were in a singing group in the late 50s. And this is the original show. There's been a sequel. The girls are back for a reunion 10 years after they graduated. Look, this story here is a bit thin. It's really an excuse to perform the old songs, which a lot of us like to hear, especially when they're done, you know, really well. So Lollipop, Dream Lover, It's My Party, Lipstick on Your Collar. That opens this week at the Meadowbrook and runs through May 19th.
I know. I'm always a sucker for a good jukebox musical. It's a lot of fun. And we now have more music to talk about.
Yeah, we're going to go to a theater we don't often talk about a lot, which is the Croswell Opera House in Adrian, which is doing Once. And that's the hit musical set in Dublin. It's a love story about a 30-something man, a busker, who is singing on the street a ballad about unrequited love. He's heard by a Czech woman who believes in his music. They become kind of a thing. The busker, he actually works in a vacuum repair shop with his dad. And so we have a love story and an artist who's trying to create while being anchored to the mundane world of work that pays the bills. It's a familiar story, but the story is a perfect vehicle for what I think is really terrific music. Many will be familiar with what has become the signature song of the show, which is Falling Slowly.
Take this sinking boat and point it home. We've still got time. Raise your hopeful voice. You have a choice. You've made it now.
Oh, yeah. I knew a lot of people that loved that. And it was a big hit. It was a very, very big, legit hit on its own.
And it gets done in coffee houses now,
yes,
the world over. And then just kind of wrapping things up, the Broadway hit Waitress, which is based on the movie the same name, We've talked about this show before when it came to the Wharton Center. It is making the rounds and will open at the DeVos Performance Hall on April 30th. And again, it'll be at the Fisher in Detroit next month on May 17th.
And of course, that's music and lyrics by Sarah Bareilles. Boy, and she actually starred on Broadway when that opened.
It's a good show, and it's also a show that attracts the younger audiences too. It's because it's modern. And then while Hamilton is closed at the Fisher in Detroit, it's moving to the Wharton for an opening on May 14th.
And my understanding, same company. So if you missed it at the Fisher, you can catch it at the Wharton. And then I know it's circling back to Michigan beginning of next year in Grand Rapids.
In Grand Rapids,
so
yes.
So there are chances. Yeah. But a lot of good theater right now to help us enjoy spring. And as always, get details on these and other shows by going to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Still to come, the Easter Sunday bombings in Sri Lanka shocked the world.
When I saw the devastation, I've seen the pictures in the New York Times, it was really heart-wrenching because these are areas that I knew as an area of peace and happiness.
We'll talk with a Michigan physician who works to support orphans in his homeland of Sri Lanka. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. April is National Poetry Month, and what better way to mark the month by talking with the high school student who is Michigan's champion in the Poetry Out Loud competition. This is a recitation contest that's coordinated by Michigan Humanities through a partnership with the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. And that means that Tasia Rain Davies will soon head to Washington to represent Michigan at the national competition. She is with us now. So, Tasia, you're from Calumet High School, which makes you the very first Poetry Out Loud champion from the Upper Peninsula. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
So this is a contest recitation for high school students. So are you reciting your own poetry or reading other poets' works? What do you have to do?
So Poetry Out Loud website, there's an anthology that you can find of at least hundreds of different poems. And you just, for your initial competition, you pick one or two at your school. And then when you get to the state level, you have to recite three. So it's not your own poetry. It's just poetry that you find means a lot to you.
And this is memorized, right? No notes.
Yeah, you have to memorize all of them.
So what poems did you choose?
I did I Have a Time Machine by Brenda Shaughnessy, and I did Quite Frankly by Mark Halliday.
And what will you be doing when you go to Washington, D.C. for the Nationals?
I'll be doing those two poems, and I will as well be doing Love 3 by George Herbert.
And why did you pick those? What spoke to you?
Well, if you asked anybody, my personality is kind of a little whimsical, and I Have a Time Machine was a very, very whimsical poem. It just spoke to my, like, funny, quirky nature. So I really liked that one. Quite Frankly was just such a beautiful depiction of memories and the human life in general to me. And then Love 3 just really spoke to my heart and just like the beliefs that I hold really, really dear. Those are the beliefs articulated throughout the poem. And it was just very beautiful to me. And I figured that if I loved them as much as I did, I could show everybody else my love for them and hopefully make them love them too.
Tasia, I know you've heard of those studies that say that people fear public speaking sometimes even more than death. Yeah, or at the very least, public speaking is way up there on the list of things people fear. Were you like that? Did you have to overcome that kind of fear to do this competition, or did you just plunge right in?
I've always been an incredibly outgoing person, but like I feel like I've never really done anything that's like astronomically amazing, you know? So I never thought that I was that good at poetry. Like, as a matter of fact, most people know this by now, but I was the runner-up at my school for the past 3 years, including this year. The only reason I went to the state competition was because the person that got first place, they'd went to the state competition years prior, and they just didn't really want to go again. And so I got the opportunity to go, and I was terrified. I was calling my teacher probably every, like, 30 minutes because I didn't recite like anybody else, and I wasn't proper and everything. And I had never, like, felt that way, I guess. I was so insecure about the way that I kind of just, like, whimsicaled myself around the stage, no matter what poem I was saying, while everyone else was standing there, and they were really proper or really funny, and I felt like I was just completely different.
Yeah, and stop and think for a minute then. So you, first of all, shouldn't have even been there because you were the runner-up.
Yeah.
You go, and you wind up just doing you, and you wind up becoming the state champion.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy.
So as you think about this national poetry competition representing the state of Michigan, what do you want to do there when you step out on that stage at George Washington University?
I just want to show people my heart through the poems, like the different sides of me, I suppose. Like there's the love shows the beliefs that I hold near to my heart, quite frankly, shows the belief that I have in the beauty of a life. And I Have a Time Machine shows my whimsical and quirky natures. Of course, I want to do Michigan proud. I want to do the UP proud. I want to do everyone proud. But I just want to go out there and say the poems better than I ever have before.
Now, when did you first discover poetry, Tasia?
I'm the youngest of nine, and my siblings have always been very musically inclined. So I started writing poetry and different little odds and ends of songs when I was younger, but I don't think I really got into poetry until my freshman year when I had the chance to do poetry out loud. And I initially did it for extra credit, but I was like, wow, these poems are actually beautiful. So I started reading more, and I'm a Christian, so I read the Bible all the time, and I love just the poeticness of that in itself. Like the Psalms are just so beautiful to me, but I love the way that somebody can work words into art. Poetry to me, I guess it sounds kind of funny, but it's really just off-brand music. Like you have a beat when you're reciting poetry and you have all of these different things, whether it's the melody or the chorus, it just sounds so beautiful. I guess it's always kind of been a part of my life, but now it's like something that really means a lot to me.
And I'm just wondering, looking ahead, do you think poetry or public recitation or perhaps theater, could that factor into your college or career plans?
I think I'm definitely going to want to, in some way, shape, or form, narrow in on communications, just because I love talking to people. I love interacting with people. And I think that the reason that I recite poetry, or maybe the reason that I love interacting with people, maybe they go hand in hand, but it's because when I talk, I love what I'm saying, or when I'm loving what I'm saying, I'm talking, if that makes any sense.
It worked. Well, it all comes down to April 30th through May 1st at George Washington University. So we want everybody to send Tasia extra good thoughts April 30th for the semifinals. And we hope we get the news that you made it to those national finals on Wednesday night, May 1st. So Tasia Rain Davies, Calumet High School, Michigan's Poetry Out Loud champion, soon to head to the nationals in Washington, D.C. Best of luck, Tasia.
Thank you so much.
To be or not to be. Of course, William Shakespeare wrote those famous words. And 403 years ago this day, William Shakespeare passed into the category of not to be, because it was on this day in 1616 that he died. Let's dig into some medical history as we say hello to Dr. Howard Markell of the University of Michigan and a PBS contributor. Howard, how sure are we that April 23rd, 1616 is when Shakespeare died?
Well, we're not entirely sure, nor are we sure of Shakespeare's birthday, which is also April 23rd.
Huh.
There is a parish record of his funeral, which was probably April 25th. And some have said his birthday may have been the 25th or 26th, but, you know, it's kind of fast and loose out there with old dates.
Well, you can't go back to the internet and check out archives for 1616.
Well, you could check the internet, but it wouldn't be from Shakespeare's day.
Well, so he was 52 when he died. How old is that by Elizabethan standards?
Yeah, that's something that's under a lot of contention among medical historians about the lifespan during the Elizabethan era. It was simply shorter, of course. There were lots of epidemics and plagues and all sorts of physical assaults and problems that could not be treated. And if they were treated by doctors, you'd probably die sooner.
So something like appendicitis could take
you're
you out.
You're gone. You're going to die if it burst. Or, you know, kidney disease or cancer or any heart disease wasn't really treated. So people did die younger. I've read numbers of in the 40s, but we know there are people who live, particularly men, in the 70s and 80s. If you were poor, Your lifespan was far shorter for obvious reasons. But even that was a discovery that wasn't made till Dickens' day, that the poor didn't die early because they were bad. They died because they were poor. And that was a striking medical fact in the 1830s. But Shakespeare was around middle age at 52, had retired over the last few years. He stopped writing poetry.
Okay, so he had dialed back.
He had dialed back. And so we consider it young today, but it was a fairly decent age. By the way, women died at an even lower lifespan.
Childbirth.
Because of childbirth. Yeah. And many women had many children, and that increased their rates of death during childbirth.
Now, do we know, had Shakespeare been sick, or was this kind
of
the blue?
No, and in fact, he had written a will about a month earlier. Now, some historians of that era say that people wrote their wills when they knew the end was near. And who better to know the grand finale of anything than William Shakespeare? But he wrote in his will, I am of sound mind and sound body. I feel great. So we don't have any clues about that.
So what kind of front-runner theories are out there as to what caused his death?
Well, his vicar wrote in his diary, albeit 50 years later, that Shakespeare went out drinking with Ben Jonson, who came in from London. Jonson was a rival playwright as well as a friend, and a poet who lived nearby named Michael Drayton. So they went out drinking, they had a great time, and then the next morning Shakespeare took ill with a fever and he died. Now that's all we really have. Now there was typhus fever brewing about Stratford-upon-Avon on that era, but there's no recording of any symptoms, and it's a rather specific pattern of symptoms. There's high fevers, delirium, and a mulberry-colored rash all over your body. It's basically blood vessels breaking under the skin. And his son-in-law was a physician, the only physician in Stratford, and there's no record in his book of patients that includes eminent patients that he ever treated Shakespeare.
Does that strike you as odd?
It does. It does. You would think if he were sick, this man would be called in, but we have no record. Now, the absence of evidence does not necessarily mean the evidence of absence, but we're kind of behind a rock in a hard spot. To me, I would bet he died of either of a stroke or a sudden heart attack.
Okay. And then you stop, as you noted in your essay for PBS, William Shakespeare has never really died. And even if you haven't seen or read his plays and sonnets, you're probably using phrases from Shakespeare every day, such as Wild Goose Chase, Romeo and Juliet, Act 2, Scene 4, Green-Eyed Monster, Othello. That's Act 3, Scene 3. Forever and a Day, which I use all the time, I didn't realize was from As You Like It. You've Got to Be Cruel to Be Kind, which became a pop tune. That's Hamlet. And the be-all and the end-all is Macbeth. So we are using him and keeping him alive.
And I think, no, it's from Lear. Life is a tale told by an idiot, full of the sound and the fury, signifying nothing.
Well, yes, indeed, Shakespeare lives. So I guess we might say happy birthday to William Shakespeare. We're not sure. Yep. Happy possible death day. And by the way, happy birthday to you.
Thank University you very
of
much.
Michigan,
thank you very much.
Sharing a date with the Bard.
Yep.
U of M medical historian and PBS contributor, Dr. Howard Markell. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We turn now to the bombings in Sri Lanka and a Michigan connection. For more than 15 years, an Ann Arbor-based nonprofit group's been bringing volunteers over to work with children in that nation. Dr. Naresh Gunaratnam is originally from the island nation. Since 2003, he has been working with a nonprofit that founded Grace Girls Home. It's an orphanage for children who've been affected by violence and poverty in Sri Lanka. Doctor, some of the board members from Michigan are there right now?
Yes, we have two board members in Sri Lanka now, and I've spoken to them, and they've given us some insights on what's happening.
What are they telling you? What are you hearing?
Well, the country is in a state of lockdown, so people are forbidden from walking around, and schools are shut. All major administrative buildings are shut down. The children at the orphanage are very frightened. A lot of those children have gone through war. Sri Lanka went through a civil war that ended in 2009, and the kids are now traumatized. We had 10 years of peace and nonviolence, and unfortunately, these bombings have reignited their post-traumatic stress.
Well, I can only imagine, and the irony that this year was meant to celebrate these 10 years of peace in Sri Lanka after that civil war. How did you feel when you heard the news of Sunday's bombings?
I was devastated. For the last 10 years, we've had relative peace. I lived through the 30 years of civil war, and it was a brutal civil war. Over 100,000 people were killed. In the last 10 years, the various ethnic groups had reconciled. There was harmony, and I think we were moving towards a peace. And this reignited all of the ethnic divisions again. And I'm fearful that partisan ethnic divisions will arise, leading to more violence.
Now, I understand that the church that you went to as a child was one of the targets on Easter Sunday. Describe this church for us and the congregation and its importance in Sri Lanka.
Well, this was St. Anthony's Church, and we used to visit it because as a five-year-old growing up, I got to light the candles. And as a five-year-old, it was a thrill, so I used to love going there because I could light, my parents would allow me to light these candles. And when I saw the devastation, I've seen the pictures in the New York Times, it was really heart-wrenching because these are areas that I knew as an area of peace and happiness. To see the devastation and the bloody bodies was really heartbreaking.
What did you hear from family members? Have you had a chance to be in touch?
I've talked to some. Everyone is very scared. They're worried about reigniting all the violence that occurred during the Civil War. There were police barricades, searches. They've just reinstituted a law that allows for anybody to question you anytime and throw you in jail. And so people are fearful that the authorities will start imposing on rights.
Now, that civil war that you talked about, and my goodness, to think that it lasted from 1983 until 2009, largely between ethnic groups, the majority Sinhalese, the minority Tamils. But as we've been hearing over the last couple of days, there are also tensions among religious groups. Buddhists, Muslims, Hindus, and Christians all live on this island nation. With your family as Christian, tell us, what is it like to be a Christian in Sri Lanka?
For the most part, Christians are tolerated because Christians are both Sinhalese and Tamils. The current tension between Muslims and Buddhists arose most recently in 2014. And then in February 2018, there was a violent protest where it started out as a traffic accident where a Sinhalese truck driver was assaulted by four Muslim youths. He was killed. That led to riots where over 400 shops were burned, houses were burned, several people died.
Were you surprised?
I wasn't, unfortunately, because I think in order to have true resolution, you have to be tolerant of every religion. You know, and unfortunately, it's a great political card to play that one group gets elected and there is ethnic division where politicians use these divisions between ethnic groups to benefit their political agendas. And unfortunately, the Sri Lankan government's political leaders are doing this, unfortunately, using Buddhist nationalists are often driving these divisions, which lead to tensions where the government leaders will say, well, you know, your lives would be great if not for this ethnic group. And if we get rid of this ethnic group, then your lives would be great. You'll all be employed, etc. And unfortunately, that political card works all over the world and throughout history.
So how might these attacks affect the work you want to do with the orphanage going forward?
It's challenging. You know, we used to go in 2002 to 2009 when there was active civil war. You know, we've been stopped by police. We've been searched. So there's always this tension. It is concerning. My wife and I had this conversation yesterday where she said, you know, I really don't want you to go. And that's an ongoing conversation. We had planned to go. We go every year and volunteer. We've taken groups as big as 60 to go volunteer. And we do simple things like, you know, last year we built a computer lab. The previous year we built some solar panels. The previous year we built a basketball court. And cleaned up the kids' rooms and these are children who've been affected by war, had lost parents due to severe violence, suffer from post-traumatic stress. And our job is just to give them innocence, you know, play with them, take them on trips, make them marshmallows and roast marshmallows in the evenings and just give them some semblance of normality. And so that innocence has been, in a way, taken away by some of this violence. But we're hoping things settle down and the leaders can appropriately calm the population down such that we can get back on the path to peace.
Dr. Naresh Gunaratnam, thank you so much for sharing your experiences with us and for the work that you're doing for these children.
Thank you, Cynthia.
And to learn more about the orphanage in Sri Lanka, just go to gracegirlshome.org. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our engineer is Mike Blank. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Bella Isaacs, Razzie Joffrey, and Katie Raymond. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.